Kick it, boys. Good afternoon, Radio Land, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby up atop the mountain here. Simon Fraser University. It's sunny, a little chilly, but nice. Nice, good May weather. And we're also on the internet at CJSF.ca and TELUS HD channel 7014. It's the first weekend, May, and I would like to say to all of you out there, May the 4th be with you. Yes, it is that special day again, Star Wars Day. So, happy May the 4th. May the 4th be with you. Don't let the Sith overrule and overtake your lives. Also, thanks to our friends at Google, they've created a lovely Google Doodle today in honor of the 360th birthday of one Bartolomeo Cristofori. Now, you may be wondering who he is. Well, he was the inventor, he was a maker of musical instruments, and he's generally regarded as the inventor of the piano. The full name is the pianoforte, which means the soft, loud in Italian. But 360th birthday, Bartolomeo Cristofori, and Google has a lovely little doodle there that you should check out. And I hope you check out this show today, because we've got a great, great one as well. I'll be speaking with bioethicist, scientist of sexuality, author, activist, and recent Twitter viral sensation, Alice Dreger. Her new book is Galileo's Middle Finger, and she also talks about the lack of sex education in the United States and what inspired her to live tweet her son's sex ed class that was taught by, in her opinion, a very ill-informed and scientifically illiterate professor. So we'll get into her with that and what inspired her to write her book Galileo's Middle Finger, and about her work with her research on intersex people, which is a very it's another one of those sexuality and gender spectrum things that is not really talked about too much. You'll also hear from actors Aaron Malkin and Alistair Knowles on their new theater piece, James and Jamesy in High Tea, which opens in Vancouver on the 22nd of May, I believe, and they're touring it around right now. So they're talking about that, and also what it was like to work with clowning and movement coach David McMurray Smith. Full disclosure: David McMurray Smith was my college theater school movement teacher for 2 years. So we'll be talking to him about that as well. And also, you'll hear the music from Bright Light Social Hour. I had a chance to talk with Jack O'Brien about their new album, Space Is Still the Place. That's where we're going to start today's show. This is a song off Space Is Still the Place, and this is Slipstream. We'll be right back. That was Bright Light Social Hour with Slipstream off their album Space Is Still the Place, and I'll be hearing from Bright Light Social Hour's Jack O'Brien a little later on in the program. Right now, though, my first guest is an American bioethicist, author, and professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois. She is known for her research on conjoined twinning, intersex, and disorders of sexual development and social justice activism. She is a fellowship recipient of the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. Her previous books include Intersex in the Age of Ethics, Hermaphrodites and the Medical Invention of Sex, One of Us, Conjoined Twins and the Future of Normal, and her most recent book released earlier this year, Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. The book covers her observations and experiences with controversies in academic medicine, especially those surrounding human sexuality. She is Alice Dreger, and she joined me on the phone last week. Alice Dreger, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you have a new book out called Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. What was the genesis of this book for you, would you say?
Well, I had spent several years doing activism around intersex. So that's when people are born with non-standard male or female anatomy, so something else either in between or some blend of traits. And I had done that for many years, sort of working on the activist side of things. And then I accidentally got into a controversy that put me sort of on the other side. That was a controversy over a book by a researcher named Michael Bailey, and he had published a book that was about transgender. It was very supportive of transgender rights, but put forth an idea that was offensive to some transgender activists, namely that transgender is partly about sexuality in addition to being about gender identity. And they had come after him, and I ended up years after that doing an investigation in terms of what had happened to him. And I thought it was going to be sort of a he said, she said thing, but it turned out that they had set Bailey up to try to sort of kill him as a messenger of a theory they didn't like. So they came after me at that point when I published my work about it, and that put me in a strange place. So I decided to go and try to talk to other scholars who had been the subject of shoutdowns by activists to kind of try to understand what that was like, but also to maintain some sympathy for the activists. So this book grew out of that.
It seems like it can be a bit of a sticky situation because, you know, obviously they're passionate about the issue and they're activists, you know, within the trans community, but sometimes I find that their activism can lead to getting basic facts wrong. So how do you blend the activist portion with the science portion of what you're doing?
Well, you know, I'm very sympathetic to people who are trying to get their rights respected, and certainly that's true for a lot of transgender people who have had their rights horrifically oppressed in terms of housing, in terms of police activity, in terms of being denied jobs, being abused in medical care systems. So what I'm really concerned about is that, but I'm also concerned that scholars and scientists be allowed to go ahead and look at issues of human identity that may not accord with what people think about themselves or want to say about themselves. So it is tricky because transgender is not a unified thing. People experience it differently, and that was part of Bailey's point. But I think what goes on is that activists are very sensitive to anybody saying anything that might disrupt their cause. So what I argue in the book is that activism is really important, but we can't do good activism without getting the facts right first, and that scientists need to be protected in terms of academic freedom to have unpopular ideas. So that's one reason the book is named after Galileo.
And I read here that you I think it was either you or Bailey that wrote something interesting that in there certain wing of the transgender community see it as almost a sexual orientation rather as a gender identity. What can you tell us about what exactly autogynephilia is in that regard?
Well, this is actually described and named by a researcher in Toronto, Ray Blanchard. And what Blanchard observed, he had people coming to him for gender identity issues and seeking sex reassignment treatments, what we now call gender affirming treatments. But at the time he was working, it was in the 1970s and 1980s. And what he found was that the men coming to him seeking to have interventions to become more feminine and to legally and socially be identified as women, that they broke into two categories. And one of the categories, according to Blanchard, was this category he called autogynephilia, which means that fundamentally these people saw themselves as women, but that that caused them some level of sexual arousal, and that they were also heterosexually attracted to women. So autogynephilia breaks down into meaning love of oneself as a woman. But Blanchard pointed out many of them also had orientations towards other women. So this was supported by his clinical data and had been supported by other people's clinical data. But it was a difficult idea to put forth among some clinicians, because some clinicians thought that transgender shouldn't be about orientation, that it had to be that you sort of had to make this claim about having be a woman, and you were always a woman inside, and that that's the way it's always been, and that therefore that's why you need access to these surgeries, as opposed to the way Blanchard saw it, which was a sort of more holistic understanding that gender and sexual orientation are intimately linked and that they have something to do with each other.
And you've also done a lot of work with intersex activists that I know, and that's not necessarily an identity or an orientation that we hear much about, you know, talked about in the media. Do you find that, or do you foresee intersex as something that will gain more noticeability in the coming years, both within the scientific community and sort of in the more mainstream press?
Well, I started working with the intersex activist movement about 20 years ago, and I would say it's significantly more visible than it used to be. So intersex is when somebody is born with some type of bodily difference that causes them to be not quite standard male or standard female. So that may be ambiguous genitalia when a child's born in between male and female, or it might be your female appearing on the outside but male appearing on the inside, or vice versa. It can mean that your sex chromosomes are something other than the usual XX for females or XY for males. So there's lots of different ways that can occur. And I think we've really increased the visibility of that over the last 20 years, and the medical care system has to some extent improved, although it still has a ways to go. I'm still working with the medical professionals to try to make care better and try to get it improved for children that are born with these conditions, because historically the way they've been treated has been very badly, as the transgender population has been treated badly as well. And it's not because the doctors don't care. It's because they have a very rigid two-sex system in the world, and they've tended to want to force everybody into one or the other. So with intersex children, that's meant a lot of unwanted genital surgeries, a lot of hiding of medical records from the patients themselves, and that's been very problematic. So we're still working on changing that system.
You know, I was reading an article on Salon, and your personal background is very interesting in terms of, you know, what led you to this activism, in terms of, you know, the Catholic family who were anti-abortion activists. How did that upbringing sort of prepare you for the work that you're doing today?
Well, I think that, you know, my parents were very much socially oriented and very much of the mind that if you were a person with any privilege, that you should use that in the service of others. My parents were not rich people. I mean, we were middle class, but their attitude was that if you have resources and you have the ability, then you help other people. So that really set me up, I think, for having a kind of life that was oriented towards social justice work. I mean, the difference is my parents were conservative and I'm a progressive, but in terms of the orientation towards trying to figure out how to make the world better, I think we shared the same orientation.
You know, and there's been so much in the States in the last, you know, 10, basically, you know, since Obama has taken power, that seems to be unnecessarily targeting women, you know, whether it's contraception or abortion. Why do you make in the political world anyway? Why do you think there's been such a pushback against women's rights?
Well, you know, in the United States, we have this problem of having a two-party system. And the two-party system tends to divide sharply along certain issues. And unfortunately, it's been the case that the Republican Party has been largely uninterested in women's issues, and the Democratic Party has focused much more on that. And so everything the Republicans hate about Obama has mapped onto everything that Obama identifies with. And so part of that is a reaction against women's rights. It's been disappointing and disturbing and frustrating, certainly. And sometimes when, you know, you travel around the world, people will say to you reasonably, how can the United States still be so far behind? And it sure feels that way on certain things. It's definitely an issue for us.
So how, in that regard, then, how important is it to have somebody like Hillary Clinton running for president and somebody like Elizabeth Warren doing what she's doing in the Senate?
Oh, really important, because it certainly provides leadership among women. But I think potentially even more important is at the level of just trying to help girls. And so we're seeing a lot more of a push now to take seriously what we call Title IX, which is a national law to try to make sure that women have equal access, girls and women have equal access to educational opportunities. And that's being used in positive ways, although also sometimes being used in problematic ways within universities. For example, the way that rape is being dealt with is very scattershot and very challenged. But I think it is getting somewhat better, but we definitely are behind a lot of other nations in terms of gender politics.
Well, on that note about rape, there was recently, I think it was a lawmaker in Tennessee who wanted to table an amendment to a rape or incest amendment to an abortion bill because, in her words, that can't be proven. So in other words, if a woman claims she has become pregnant by rape or incest, there is no way to prove that allegation, and therefore it should not be included. What do you make of that assertion?
You know, it just feels like we're living in the Middle Ages. I mean, it really reminds me of some middle age attitude towards, you know, that a woman couldn't get pregnant if she were raped because she wouldn't produce a seed if she were raped. She must have been sexually stimulated. These are such backwards, crazy ideas that I'm often finding myself ashamed. I do. I'm not kidding. I have a T-shirt that says "Proud to Want to Be Canadian," and when I see stuff like that, it's where I feel really like it's necessary to reiterate that America is not number one on many issues.
Well, as someone who was born and born and raised in Canada, it just strikes me as a little odd because that type of stuff has never been an issue for us. You know, we, Henry Morgenthaler, we've always had a good healthcare system, and we all find it a little bit peculiar at times, the priorities of some of the American lawmakers.
Yeah, you should feel kind of curious. I mean, it is, you know, for example, I mean, we still don't have nationwide gay marriage. We might have that after June, after the Supreme Court makes a decision. But yes, it's late in the game at this point internationally, but we still have these issues going on. We still don't have basic transgender rights here to the extent you guys do. I mean, you guys still have more to do too, but it's really quite shocking how far behind the United States is on many things. It's a puritanical nation, I'm afraid.
I wanted to talk to you because last week you became a bit of a viral sensation when you live tweeted your son's sex ed class. How did that come about, and what gave you the decision that's like, okay, I'm gonna live tweet this idiocy?
You know, I never thought it was going to be read by millions of people. I had at the time 2,200 Twitter followers, many of whom had picked me up for my writings about sex ed at Pacific Standard, so I thought they would be interested to know what my son was being taught now because I've written about his poor sex education before. So I really just decided to live tweet it mostly to keep my mouth shut in the classroom, mostly because I thought my personal followers would find it interesting. I never thought the class was going to be as bad as it was, teaching that good girls say no and bad girls say yes and the condoms fail 1 out of 6 times and you get pregnant every time that happens. And, you know, I'm a writer, so, and I have a sense of humor, so I guess they were funny and I should have perhaps kept my mouth shut. But it was ultimately very positive because it did go viral. It traveled all over the world and people are now talking about sex ed, and progressives are trying to figure out what's going on in their children's classroom, which I take as a very good thing.
So do you, like, in that regard, in terms of the misinformation or the ideological slant that a lot of these sex ed classes have, do you find it anti-women, anti-sex? Is there a difference or a conflation between the two?
I think very much both, anti-women but also anti-sex. I mean, they were sex-shaming the boys as well in this classroom, so the boys were not exempted from that kind of shaming. But that said, the focus was much more on the assumption that girls are the ones who can be tainted and polluted and, you know, boys can't be trusted was the attitude, which I also found problematic. So It was equally bad, I would say, for both genders, although perhaps more anti-woman than anything else. It was definitely anti-sex. I mean, the attitude was very much, you know, if you have to have sex, you know, like talking about sex as if it's something you would only do if you had to have it. And so there was very much no discussion of the pleasures of sex, of the positive joys of sex, certainly outside of marriage. They couldn't tolerate that idea, people who were there. So it was a very problematic way of teaching sex.
And, you know, especially when it comes to, I think, you know, I've been reading, especially when it comes to, you know, literature and stuff, female sexuality, especially teenage female sexuality, seems to be still taboo in a lot of ways. What do you think needs to be done to change the attitudes toward that?
Well, I think one of the things that's going to have to change is just the older generations are going to have to die off, to be honest. I think this has always been one of the ways that attitudes towards sex has changed, is just that people who are more prudish, who are older, get over it and then die. And that the younger generations understand that, in fact, you know, we don't have to have this puritanical understanding of sex, that sex can be something that can be done respectfully with consent and be pleasurable and not be a disaster for people. So I really think that's important. You know, teaching boys that the girls who say no are the girls you want is just so incredibly problematic from so many points of view that I can't believe we're even still talking like that. You know, you really want to teach boys that and girls that sex requires both parties saying yes, both parties being ready, both parties being prepared for, you know, consequences, talking about emotional, psychological, physical, and then allowing people to find it pleasurable so that they can enjoy that aspect of their bodies and themselves. But that was not the attitude in this classroom. So,
and finally, you've in the title of your book, you've referenced sort of the at least one of the fathers of modern science. What makes Galileo such an important figure, and why did you decide to title your book Galileo's Middle Finger?
Well, Galileo was sort of the ultimate scientist standing up to a dogma, and so what I was doing in invoking his name for this book was looking at scientists who had challenged dogma, in this case mostly leftist dogma, people who had challenged leftist activists. And so I was sort of invoking his name for that reason and really trying to think about, well, what had happened to Galileo and were we past that point where groups with lots of political power who were threatened by the scientists could essentially house arrest the scientist and stop them from doing any further work. And that is what I found. And so that's why the book is about that.
Well, it's a great book, and you're certainly doing great work with conversations that need to be had and, you know, getting the correct information out there. The book is Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. Alice Dreger, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, and I'll just mention it was just named a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, so thank you.
All right, have a good day. Cheers.
You too, Dan. Thank you.
That was Alice Dreger, and she spoke to me via Skype a couple weeks ago. You can visit her website, alicedreger.com, or follow her on Twitter, at Alice Dreger. Dreger is Dreger. Okay, we have a couple of announcements for you, and then you're going to hear from Jack O'Brien of Bright Light Social Hour. Ever CGSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. The Bright Light Social Hour are coming to Vancouver on May the 6th, and they're touring across Canada and the U.S. right now. You can check their website for full details. Earlier today, I had a chance to speak with Jack O'Brien from Bright Light Social Hour about their new album, Space Is Still the Place.
Cool.
Zach, thanks for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the new album is Space Is Still the Place. What can you talk about, or what can you say in terms of how this album came about? Sort of what was the genesis for it?
I'm spending a lot of time on the road, really. I think it just, you know, you get a lot of time to think and talk and meet people, and, you know, ever-changing environments. It's just really, I don't know, got us talking and thinking a lot about, like, well, mainly we're touring a lot in the southern part of the U.S., so it was like, you know, what is the music of this place, and, like, what do we want to say, and what are the people here, you know, what speaks to them, and I don't know, so all of that kind of got us going, and I think that's kind of where it all started.
Now, I know this group started in art school, if I read, like a collective in art school. Talk to us about that time, the initial coming together of the band.
So yeah, I was a little liberal arts school in Central Texas called Southwestern University, where Curtis and I were going to school, and being in a small town in the middle of kind of, you know, Texas, I was very surprised to find he posted like a, you know, a little bulletin email thing looking to put a band, and he had all these really out there influences I didn't think anybody else was listening to at the time. It was like hardcore experimental stuff, like the Blood Brothers and the Dillinger Escape Plan, and so I was super stoked, and we kind of got going right away, but it was always kind of a hobby while we were in school, and then I spent some time abroad, and we both ended up going to grad school and moving to Austin, and we found Joe there on Craigslist, and then he was friends with our keyboardist, Edward, and they DJed a lot together, so we brought him in, too.
Growing up in Texas, what was that like for you, you know, being someone who's interested in the arts, and where did you go for, you know, creative inspiration?
I mean, Austin, you know, is where I grew up, and that's where, you know, I always was, and there's always just so much of that going on, so much music and so much art and so much, you know, creativity, and also like a lot of creative entrepreneurs and people like that. So it's just a really vibrant energy. I think that, you know, it was just really inspirational and cool to be around people trying really different stuff and very ambitious young people.
Speaking of Austin, what do you think South by Southwest has done to sort of revitalize the live concert?
Well, South by Southwest is interesting, you know, because it was just like originally it was just like this little kind of weekend festival and kind of a place for music industry people to just, you know, meet and check out bands they're potentially interested in, get it all in one place. And so, you know, for it to explode into this big kind of public thing, I don't know. I think it's really cool. A lot of Austinites don't like it because it's just like the city is overrun with people and just trying to find free drinks all the time. But there's just so many people who love music. It's so much great live music, and it's cool because it's not like a normal festival where you've got huge stages. It's like every coffee shop and restaurant and like bookstore, anything that could possibly fit a band in it has music. So I think it's, yeah, I mean, it's done a really good thing for that. And Austin is always a huge live music town. I think there's like 200 live music venues in town. So, you know, it's cool to like bring people from all around the world into that culture and see, you know, like, hey, we can have Austin shows day and night and enjoy and share music. It's cool.
If I may, I was hoping I could ask you briefly about Alex and the impact that his passing had on the band.
Well, I mean, definitely huge. You know, I mean, he was, you know, my brother, our manager for almost 4 years, and you know, he started kind of showing little symptoms of kind of like mania, you know, bipolar. And, you know, at first we didn't think much of it, but because he was always just such a like high wired, really energetic, really fun dude. And so, you know, but then it started, he would kind of slip into really serious depressive episodes, and then he would kind of shoot back up a limb, and then they just started getting more and more intense to the point where he was kind of really losing touch with reality, and you know, and so it was good. He was very like, he really, you know, he knew, so he kind of, well, as soon as he kind of, you know, knew that this was getting worse, he really took it upon himself to teach us everything about the business, because he really helped us, you know, we really grew this as a business together, and he was the head of that. So he, you know, made sure we knew how to do all of our accounting, all of everything, before he kind of resigned to kind of just focus on his health. But he, it, you know, it was interesting. He always, he always said that he felt like, or at that point, once, you know, it kind of really took a hold of him, the mental, you know, I don't want to call it mental illness, I think a mental disease, a brain disease is a more appropriate term, but but once he really got to get a hold of it on, he kind of just knew, you know, it was his time, and that he had lived, he felt like an old man who lived like rich, beautiful life, and he just felt like it was, you know, his time, and you know, he was resistant to every treatment and everything. So, you know, we all lived with him. He lives in our studio, and so it was very difficult because we were dealing with that on a day-to-day basis. But you know, but at the same time, we also, I think we were lucky to be with him all the time and to really see how much he was suffering and how really terrible it got. When I think that from the outside, if you just hear that, you know, somebody with that you know, who I hadn't seen for a while or heard about, you know, just passed, took his own life, that it sounds a lot more shocking, I guess. But us being there, it was really, you know, it was being with somebody who was passing from cancer. You see the struggle and you kind of, you know, see that the passing is as the next step. It's the right thing to alleviate suffering.
And I'm curious as to the band's overall writing process. Would you say that you come up with a melody first and then add lyrics to it? Do you write lyrics separately as a group? How do you all function?
All kinds of ways, really. I think that's always something we're trying to do, is like explore new ways of writing all the time. So, you know, we used to always kind of write everything with everybody in the room and just jam a ton with all the inks going all the time, but it's such a slow process to go that way. We found over time that, like, you know, we'd start that way with a jam with everybody in the room and then, you know, record it, and then we'd listen back and one of us like, hey, there's this section here, this is really magic, like let's dive in and kind of zoom in on this feel. And then we'd talk about, like, what does this make you imagine and what does it make you feel, and like what does this music want to say, and then we'd kind of develop lyrics along and melodies alongside the develop, like the arranging of the song, just kind of get it all going.
What would you say is your favorite song off of Space Is Still the Place?
My personal favorite is probably The Moon, the second to last track.
Well,
I just find it, I don't know. Yeah, it's just a very different thing than what we've normally done. And I don't know, it's just a very special song for me, too.
Well, the album is Space Is Still the Place. All the listeners should check it out. Jack O'Brien, Bright Light Social Hour, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much.
Jack O'Brien from the Bright Light Social Hour. They will be in Vancouver on May the 6th, check their website or Facebook for full details. Up next, we have two great hilarious actors, Aaron Malkin and Alistair Knowles, who joined me last week to talk about their new touring theater piece, James and Jamesy in High Tea.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing today?
Great.
This
I'm super
is
happy to be on the show.
this is an interesting piece that you guys came up with. How did the origin of this show start for you?
Well, Aaron and I have been involved in clown work in Vancouver for quite a number of years, and we were part of a clown group called the Poop Bomb Parade, and James and Jamesy emerged as an improvised sketch. It was a 3-minute sketch that we decided it was worthy of putting on stage. So at our debut show, the James and Jamesy sketch was one of many, and the response it got was sort of over the moon. And our clown teacher, who was in the audience, saw us and said, you guys got something, you guys got the gold, this is it, if you want it, run with it. So with that encouragement and encouragement from the audience response, we sought out opportunities to grow what was a 10-minute sketch into a 20-minute show, then a 25-minute show, And then eventually we thought, hey, let's do a full show and take it on the road. So by December of that year, we debuted it in March, and by December, we had a 60-minute performance that was ready for the road.
How was that process like for you, going from this 3-minute improvisational piece to essentially a full-length theater piece?
It was really exciting for us. We'd done some full-length shows before, but with this one, what was new about it was that we were sort of adding to it incrementally, and with each addition, brought new awareness to our characters, our relationship, and what we started doing was integrating audience members into the show. The very first 10-minute sketch, the audience interaction was a very literal breaking of the fourth wall, saying hello to them. And that's pretty much all the involvement we had initially. But by the time the 60-minute show came around, we had the whole audience enveloped in a dance party, in a photo shoot. The whole audience became the army and the British army. And so we sort of realized how much we enjoyed conducting the audience in an experience where they got to play.
I've heard your show described as a child's imagination on steroids.
How is
that an accurate description for you? How would you describe the insanity that your show provides to an audience?
This is Aaron speaking.
Oh, hey, Aaron.
Hey. I would say my character James, I'm a gentle giant of sort, and I go to James's house for a weekly tea party. My life is pretty kind of straight, and it's through James's imagination that my world just opens up and becomes so vivid and spectacular. It's the main reason I go to James's house is because of how enriched my life becomes through that weekly ritual.
Something that's quite exciting about our dynamic is my character, Alistair, Jamesy, is so extreme in his particularity that if I was the only one on stage, it would be hard for the audience to go with me. But James acts as this conduit between my eccentricities and the audience's sort of wariness but intrigue of those eccentricities, and his willingness to go along on my journey invites the audience in, paired with my willingness to invite the audience in. So I'm trepidatious to have anyone over than James for tea, yet given there's an audience there, I'm asked to step out of my comfort zone. The audience is asked to step out of their comfort zone, and together we're able to create a rich journey of the imagination where everyone is part of.
And I have to ask you about one of my favorite people in the world, David McMurray Smith. I know you guys, this arose out of a clown class you took with him. I just studied with him for 2 years as part of my theater school training. What can you tell us about his originality to the approach that he uses and how that helped you foster your characters over time?
His approach is a very humanistic approach. When throughout the training, we're encouraged to expose parts of ourselves and delight in the discovery and the sharing of what it means to be us. And that transparency creates a dialogue with the audience where we're all in that experience and sharing together. And that connection is really what holds our shows together. James and Jamie are not out to shock, we're not out to make fun of, we're not out to have a laugh at anyone's expense. It's all about sharing our joy of performing and our shared of the joy of performing these two characters in particular.
I would say something fundamental in David's work is this notion called the body of delight, that at the core of any character we play, we're playing it like a child plays with a toy. There's genuine delight kind of beaming from us, and there's a contagiousness, you know, when you know, a dog jumps out of a car and starts running around and frolicking, people start giggling. So that contagiousness, we come into the show with this body of delight underneath what we're doing, and kind of stealthily, slowly, people get on board that play, and eventually we all find avenues to play together in the theater in the context of the show.
Before our shows, you might think, oh, before a show, people are running their lines. In our show, we are literally rolling on the floor, laughing, cultivating the delight within us, so that we, by the time we step on stage, we are so full of the joy of performing and the joy of this being, that as soon as we step on stage, we're just ready. It's bubbling out of us such that the audience can't help but see the fun we are having.
You talk a lot about how you encourage participants, the audience, or, you know, those who take part in your workshop to step out of their comfort zone and sort of inspire self-worth and individuality, which also falls in line with David's work. Why is that aspect of performing important to you, rather than just letting the audience watch?
For me, it's exhilarating. I remember wondering if people wondering about the meaning of life, and I find that nobody has that question when they're in the midst of joy. To experience joy, and to experience joy with others, is reason in itself for me, and it's a place I love being. And the challenge of the show, which is one challenge, is to take a room of people watching a theater show and turning it into something where everyone is in that delight together, and choosing to play. There's no other place I'd rather be.
Value is the range of emotion that the training we've done and the work allows us in our everyday life. By stretching those emotional muscles, we feel we become humans with a greater range of emotion and emotional transparency, and we, with our shows and workshops, try to cultivate the transparency to which we can communicate our emotions, so that we remain in a state of honesty. And we feel there's great value in that.
Artists often talk about how tragedy and melancholy make for great inspiration. So I'll ask you the reverse. Why is happiness and joy good entertainment?
I think play is good entertainment. So in our play, there is happiness and joy, and there is also the agony and grief.
Melancholy.
But what we do is we play that range of emotion.
So people don't sit there worrying about us, but they get to experience separation. They get to experience sadness, but there's a kind of, they get to experience that with like a warm blankie on them.
It's the awareness that we are playing, and we are all playing together, gives the audience a safety to explore their own emotional range while being held in a container that they feel safe in. The container, in this case, being our show, High Tea.
Would you say that your show is, in a way, the the manifestation of the two extremes of agony and ecstasy?
I would say there is, yes, we cultivate situations that thrust us into desperation, into the agony, and there's also, we play the immense joy of discovery, the joy of playing together. In high tea, the world floods with tea, and through an accident. And James and Jamesy have very different ideas as to how to deal with this predicament. And so their different approaches are both challenging for each other and the audience, and also create fantastic, rich situations as they come to resolutions.
Go ahead.
The swing from agony to ecstasy isn't in itself a North Star or a guiding principle for this show, but I would say in most theater, people love seeing people get changed or be changed, and it's just very there's a lot of satisfaction for the performer and the audience to see swings in emotion. And in the work that we do, it's always there.
You guys, I think I read you guys have been named the best of Fringe or best of Fest Fringe winners 10 times. You know, one or two would be enough for a lot of people. But what's it like for you being named that 10 times?
It's been an eye opener to how accessible this style of theater is and how people get something out of it that has them telling other people about it. As we tour our shows across the country, we are so delighted with how the word of our show has preceded our arrival. At last year's Fringe Festivals, we sold out every single one of our seats for the last four festivals we were in. And how, you ask, how does that happen or how does that feel? It's exhilarating. Of those Best of Fest things, awards included have been Best Comedies, Best Script, Best Physical Theater, Most Outstanding Performance. So what's been delightful for us is having the different elements of our show, the physical theater element of it, the comedy element, the script element, all be recognized. We've either won awards or sold out entire runs at every festival we've been a part of.
Aaron, I read somewhere that you have a degree in experimental education, and I'm curious how you think that plays into the show, given what it is and how sort of family friendly the whole experience can be.
I focused an education degree on experiential education, which really put the focus on doing, on generating experiences, and reflecting on those experiences for what lessons we may draw, other than the experiencing of them themselves. I would say the main thing that degree provided me with was experience in a community of people so genuinely connected to what they did. They loved it had a focus on outdoor education, actually. And when I look at my history, the choices I've made, I loved teaching, and when I discovered the clown work in the physical theater, it added a richness to my life that I was looking for but didn't know how to access. And now I get to share that with people, both in the shows we do and in the workshops we teach. And it's very experiential, because the learning is things your body needs to do in order to get it.
And finally, how, you know, you guys have been touring the show for a while. How different does the show become, you know, day to day, or fringe to fringe, or, you know, month to month, year to year, that sort of thing?
There's one thing that we have a show with the same characters called Two for Tea, and this show, High Tea, is a totally new adventure with the same characters. And so the life of High Tea, has its roots in Two for Tea and then takes it further. As we develop our show, because our shows involve audiences to such a high degree, it's essential to have showings in the show's development. So we consider the Fringe Festival tour, where we put on 40 or 50 shows, the training ground for the show itself. Each show is a rehearsal. We are, after each show, we are commenting on what worked, what didn't work, what moments can we integrate in a reliable way. Sometimes we have audience experiences that are so rich that we then try to shape a setup such that we can reliably cultivate that experience. From the time the show leaves Vancouver, or left Vancouver in by the time High Tea left Vancouver in May of 2014, and when it returned to Vancouver after the Fringe tour, the script had settled quite a bit. Our own comfort with the trajectory and the variety of audience responses had solidified, and we were able to then create a reliably hilarious show that integrated audiences in a way that was both meaningful and spontaneous, and achieved our objective of having a show where people are delighted to see it and allows for its continued life. So we have over 100 performances scheduled for 2015, which we consider the Fringe Festival last year the training ground for those 100 shows.
Speaking of shows, James and Jamesy in High Tea will be in Vancouver at the Jericho Arts Center May 18th to 24th.
And that was Aaron Malkin and Alistair Knowles, James and Jamesy in High Tea, and I spoke with them last week. Ah!